Fields. This is the first day of the new 2010-2011 year. And to celebrate, we have a new judge. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. And to my right, a seasoned appellate judge as opposed to Justice Gabriel, who's a seasoned trial judge, Justice Sue Walker, and I'm Leanne Dofino. We're going to hear one case, Arona, and then we'll recess for a new panel to hear the second case, which is Otero. And that's what we have for today. So we'll get started. I understand both sides are ready. So Megan, would you call the case, please?
May it please the court, Mr. John Stickles to argue for appellant and Ms. Deborah Ann Windsor to argue for the state.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm here today representing Mr. Arona in this case. Basically, there's no dispute on the facts. The facts are pretty much straightforward. There's really no dispute on the law between Mr. Arona and the government. The dispute is how that law is applied to the facts. What I want to talk about primarily are two issues. One is that there's insufficient evidence to prove that Mr. Scott Sartain is deceased. And the second one is the trial court's failure to include a lesser-included offense of criminally negligent homicide in the jury charge. With regard to Mr. Sartain being deceased, admittedly, to prove corpus delicti of murder, the state does not have to show Mr. Sartain's body. They don't have to recover his body, but they do have to show that Mr. Sartain died and that death was caused by some person committing a criminal act.
You don't think showing somebody a severed head is some indication of death?
Well, if you show his severed head, but his severed head was never produced, Your Honor, the closest that came was some witness that said they picked his head up by the ear. And I don't think that witness testified that his head was severed, just that he picked his head up by his ear. And that you would have to believe that witness was telling the truth, and the evidence is disputed on whether that witness is actually truthful. With that regard, according to the facts and according to the state's version of the events, Mr. Sartain was held in the back room for an extended period of time. He was beaten severely over an extended period of time. Yet there was not any DNA whatsoever found of Mr. Sartain in that back room. If the state's version of the events are true, there would have been some DNA in the form of blood, something for Mr. Sartain in that back room. However, after extended search, there was no DNA produced. I think that tends to show that Mr. Sartain is not deceased, but is, like his mother said, maybe off hiding somewhere. She testified in court that he had a passport, that he likes working in the oil fields, that he might be in the Midland, Odessa, Permian Basin area, that he liked working around San Angelo, and that from time to time he has left and not appeared for an extended period of time. Based on the fact that there was no DNA whatsoever found anywhere of Mr. Sartain, combined with the fact that his mother's testimony, it's reasonable to believe that he is not deceased and is, in fact, hiding somewhere because he didn't want to pay for the crimes he committed. And based on that, we submit that the state has not proven that Mr. Sartain is deceased, and because of that, Mr. Arona cannot be guilty. With regard to the criminal negligent homicide, we submit that the trial court erred by failing to submit the charge of criminally negligent homicide to the jury. The state's version of the facts would show that Mr. Sartain is diabetic and that the cause of his death, if you believe the state's view, was that Mr. Sartain is deceased because Mr. Arona and others kept him, didn't give him insulin, and because of that, he died. However, there is no proof in the record to show that Mr. Arona knew that Scott Sartain was an insulin-dependent diabetic. There is no evidence to show that any of Mr. Sartain's acquaintances knew he was diabetic. Since there's no, and there's no proof to show that Mr. Arona knew that Mr. Sartain was diabetic, if you are unaware of the fact, if Mr. Arona was unaware of the fact that Mr. Sartain was diabetic, and because he was unaware, failed to provide insulin to him, and because of that, Mr. Sartain died, then you have criminally negligent homicide instead of murder. The facts of this case are such that the jury could have convicted Mr. Arona of criminally negligent homicide, and the failure to submit that charge to the jury, we believe, was error on the part of the trial court. Now, the state has argued in a reply brief that this charge did include the mental state of recklessness, and that by the jury, by finding Mr. Arona guilty of the offense of murder, somehow rejected the idea that he might be guilty of criminally negligent homicide. However, the charge of reckless mental state and criminally negligent mental state are not the same. And the jury, given that choice between recklessness and murder, could have chosen murder, whereas given the choice between criminally negligent homicide and murder.
Go ahead.
If I remember a criminal jury charge, it guides the jury through their choices. The first choice being the indicted offense, in this case, murder. And it says if you find beyond a reasonable doubt A, B, C, and D, then find him guilty. If you do not so find, or if you have a reasonable doubt thereof, then next consider the next most serious offense, which would have been manslaughter. By the fact that they never got to manslaughter, that they found him guilty of murder, doesn't that then reasonably mean that they would have certainly never gotten the criminally negligent homicide if they're guided in that fashion?
Not necessarily, because the jury is also told to read the entire charge all the way through before they make a decision. And in that reading the charge, they would get past the murder charge and get down to recklessness, and they would have gotten down to criminally negligent homicide. Unfortunately, we don't know what they would have decided on that because they weren't charged with that.
Says, as the state cited, that if there's an intervening offense that was submitted, that in most instances, that in fact means that it's not error to submit the lesser charge.
Yes, ma'am. In addition, in a criminal charge, before the application paragraph, the charge sets out the various definitions of the offenses, and the charge recklessness charge would have been set out there, and the criminally negligent charge would have been set out there also. So the jury knew what recklessness was, rejected that by finding him guilty of murder. When we submit that if they would have had the choice of criminally negligent homicide, they could have made that choice. Yes, ma'am.
I've got a question. Most of the evidence came in through co-defendants. Is that right? Or people who may have had some complicity, and maybe maybe there could have been an accomplice charge, either accomplice as an issue of fact or accomplice as a matter of law.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. My question is whether the statements of others made in furtherance of a conspiracy, as the state argues, require the same corroboration as the testimony of an accomplice, since they may have been, conspiracy wasn't charged. But the state's theory is their testimony was admissible and not excluded as hearsay or denial of confrontation because they were statements in furtherance of the conspiracy. Do they require corroboration? I don't know, and so that's why I'm asking you what your opinion is.
Well, I'm going to give a long answer.
All right.
In my opinion is the statements of the there's three statements that I was concerned about. The statement of Mr. Jones, Mr. Brower, and Mr. Osborne. They were not co-conspirators. They are
accomplices.
fellow drug users that hung out in the house, for lack of a better word.
Okay.
Those witnesses testified as to hearsay statements made by various co-conspirators, including the main defendant, Mr. Kelly Munn.
Mm-hmm.
Those statements were objected to at trial based upon hearsay and based upon confrontation clause. The response to that hearsay objection was that the statements were admissible hearsay because they were admissions against interest. If you read the record, those statements were in truth and in fact not admissions against interest because the persons that made those statements did not implicate themselves in any criminal or civil liability. Therefore, if the statements are not admissible hearsay, which we contend the judge erred in admitting those statements because they're not admissions against interest, then Mr. Arona's Sixth Amendment right was violated because he did not have the chance to cross-examine them. And since they were not admissible hearsay, the traditional test as to truthfulness of hearsay was not met.
Okay. But if they were, as the state argues, at least I seem to remember it was the state that argued statements in furtherance of the conspiracy, and if they aided or assisted or encouraged in any way, even the hiding him until he was dead, that would, you know, assure his death if he died. Do statements in furtherance of a conspiracy among co-conspirators or people who might be a co-conspirator or might be a party as an issue of fact, do they have to be corroborated as an accomplice statement has to be corroborated?
If they were made in furtherance of the conspiracy, then they would have to be corroborated. That's our position.
Do you have any law on that?
I can get some.
Okay. I'd appreciate it.
Yes, ma'am.
And on the charge error, what evidence is there that he actually died of failure to receive insulin?
If memory serves me correct, the only evidence there is of the evidence that would tend to prove that he died from not receiving insulin was a medical examiner who testified that for this length of time, subject to these conditions, that a person who was insulin diabetic could have died from not receiving insulin.
Okay. Or could have bled to death internally, or could have been alive when they dismembered the body, or, okay.
Assuming the body was dismembered, Your Honor.
Assuming that
Mr. Sartain is not hiding out in the oil fields of West Texas somewhere.
And who was it, I've forgotten, who testified they saw his head?
I don't remember right off the top who it was. It was one of the persons, one of the fellow drug users who hung out at the house.
Was it Brower or was it one of the others?
It might have been Mr. Brower. I don't remember.
I can't remember. Wouldn't that make a difference? How active a participant this person was, and whether it needed to be corroborated?
Absolutely. And I will be submitting a post-submission brief, Your Honor.
You have anything else you want to?
No, ma'am.
Talk to us about.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Deborah Windsor with Tarrant County DA's office representing the state in this case.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt. Don't count this against her time. This podium was designed for Deborah because it was originally much taller, and Deborah couldn't see over it. And so she came into court, and it was cut down for her. So for whatever that's worth, that's just a little history of the court. So that's why the podium where y'all speak is the height it is, because it had to fit Deborah. So, okay.
And I will just say that I take that to mean that, you know, I sort of own the courtroom because it was built for me. But I just appreciate the fact that y'all don't make me stand on a box or anything.
That was
the other alternative, and very, very glad. I do want to start out, with the exception of the very last thing, I don't think we have a huge dispute as to what the law is on most of these issues. I think this is just a case where we're going to get into disagreement about how to apply the facts at trial to that law. I will say in answer to Justice Stefano's question on corroborating co-conspirator when it's hearsay, I'm going to take the position you don't have to, because I don't remember seeing any law that talked about that. I will give the huge caveat, though, that honestly had never thought about that until you asked the question. So I will be looking and trying to do some research as well. So that's my inclination, but, you know, I haven't researched that. I could be wrong. If I do find something, then I would be happy to submit a post-submission letter brief given the case law.
Do you remember who it was who testified and saw the severed head?
Yes, ma'am. It was Brian Johns.
It was Johns who was...
It was Johns who was... I don't want to belabor the facts and you know, bore everybody to tears when you do have it in the brief. He was the one whose wife was arrested when they went to the bank to cash the check. He was also involved in the initial
beating.
You know, the way I read the testimony was they basically threw a few punches. At that point, appellant took over. It turned into just a savage beating, at which point everybody in the house, which is mostly drug users, came into the room, freaked out, stop, you know, they're not going to stop. They all just scatter. I hate to say like cockroaches, but when I read the record, I was just like, you know, that was the thing that came to mind, was just this drug house and these people there. But, you know, when something really serious, it's one thing to have criminal stuff going on and somebody taking a punch or two, but when the beating got to a certain point, they scattered. They didn't want any part of it, which I think says something as to the kind of beating it was.
Is there any evidence other than testimony, any physical evidence of his blood in that house or in the garage? If he was supposed to be dismembered and beaten to death, there would be, and then left there, there would be bodily fluids, there would be possibly blood. Is there any of that in that house?
There is, and let me start, Your Honor, by saying, if I'm remembering right, it was 7 months before there was any kind of look at the house. So, number one, 7 months has passed. At least one person knew is living in the house. Mine and appellant are no longer living there. Somebody else is. Whether there had been more somebodies in between, I don't know. The police sprayed one room with something called, if I'm pronouncing it right, leukocrystal violet, but I'm not sure they read the directions properly. Maybe it's one way to put it. It showed up some spots where there could be blood. They left for a while, came back. Unfortunately, what they didn't realize was that it also reacted to sunlight. So when they came back the second time, thinking to get the samples, the whole room was purple. They couldn't find the original spots. They did collect the baseboards at the beginning, but that was it. And they testified that once you use the substance to try to find traces, it starts degrading the DNA. So I will throw that, whether there was DNA there or not, I don't know, but after that point, there likely wasn't anymore. The other interesting thing about the record is there's testimony, a few mentions, of them hauling away a bathtub when they hauled the trash bags and the car down to Waco to this odd-sounding place where things were cut up and burned. We don't know. He could have been in a bathtub at least for part of this, and that could explain where some of the bodily fluids went. We do know from numerous witnesses, though, that this is just gross to me, but the house, apparently from even outside the house, at some point it just started smelling very badly, very strongly, to the point where the appellant and Mr. Munn had fixed vapor rub under their noses. They had dryer sheets placed in the vents. They had the air conditioning turned down very low, and people were just staying away from this house. So whether that's physical evidence, I would suggest it is. It's not the kind of DNA evidence that you would like to have, but it is a lot of people showing something horrible happened at this house. And then, you know, at that point, they cut the body up. Mr. Johns testified to seeing the severed head. He apparently freaked out, maybe is a good way to put it, a colloquial way to put it, ran out of the house, which is understandable. What he did, though, he runs to a nearby motel where some of his friends who use drugs are staying, and basically tells them, oh, my God, you're not going to believe what I just saw. And they did testify that he came to him upset and talked about seeing something to that effect.
What about the jury charge?
As far
if there was, what is the evidence that appellant knew and consciously disregarded the risk of death, knew about the insulin dependence?
Whether he knew about the insulin, you know, I think there's enough there to say he did know about it. There was testimony that the victim left his insulin. He tried to find, since he didn't really have a home of his own, he tried to find people he could stay with that had a refrigerator where he could keep the insulin. Munn made some comments about, yeah, we know he's diabetic. Somebody else remembered seeing him trying to shoot meth up the same way he took his insulin. There's conflicting evidence on who knew he was diabetic and what they knew as to his insulin needs. But what we do know is that he was, after the beating, he was taken to the garage. We know someone saw a photograph Munn took of him, and he used it to scare people into paying debts. That the victim's face was extremely swollen and brutalized. We know that they turned up music to keep his moans from being heard. We know they referenced, you know, something about a dog. And so they took actions to basically conceal him and keep him in the garage. If you have someone who suffered a beating, they're moaning. I don't know how you could say you didn't realize there was a risk that somebody was going to die, and especially if you keep them in the garage. And here there's evidence that at some point he did die because we have the odor of death and we have them dismembering his body.
But wasn't the reckless charge dealing specifically with the insulin?
I didn't remember that it did.
Okay.
I think it was the way, if I'm remembering correctly, and please look at the charge to see, but the way I thought it was charged was basically same manner of means, which would include the manner of means unknown, is the actual cause of death. And I think reading the record, you know, my personal opinion is that's probably the fairest thing to say. We don't really know exactly. Without an autopsy, I don't know that you can ever really say exactly how he died. It could have been from the beating, because it sounds like the beating was certainly severe enough. He was kicked in the head and the face. There was blood on their shoes. He was kept in a garage where he was moaning. They were covering up the noise. So I think there was certainly some evidence there that he, you know, it took him a little while to die, but it was clear that they were waiting around for him to die. One other thought I just thought of, going back to the evidence as to why no DNA, there was a lot of testimony in there, too, about Mr. Munn and appellant using all sorts of cleaners and just cleaning that house, just cleaning away. Various people talked about, I think a couple of people named Fabulosa cleaner specifically, which struck me as interesting that two people would name the exact same cleaner, and it's really not one I had ever heard of. And you do have evidence of mopping the floors and scrubbing. So I think that's, you know, clearly they were trying to cover up and hide any evidence, and apparently they were quite successful. Last thing I'll say is, I do think on the lesser included offense, I don't think that there was any evidence to suggest criminally negligent homicide, but I do think the fact that the jury rejected, you know, and found intentionally or knowing and didn't get to reckless, however you want to look at it, whether they read the charge as a whole and rejected it or just never got there. But either way, they found intentionally or knowingly. I think recklessly was more the theory of the case that they argued to the jury, you know, that, oh, well, you know, we didn't know he was diabetic. You know, but again, you have somebody who's moaning, you're covering it up, you're keeping them in the garage. So I don't think there was any evidence of it, but I think also the fact that the jury rejected that recklessness argument shows that in any error that there could have been in failing to give the criminally negligent homicide charge would have been harmless. If the court doesn't have any other questions, the state will rely on its brief and ask that this case be affirmed. Thank you.
But you will get us something on corroboration.
If I can find something, Your Honor. I'm going to go back to my office and look right now.
Okay.
It's sad. I always think, you know, I'm going to be prepared, and you're not going to surprise me, but you always manage to have something. I go, oh, I didn't think of that. So I will go.
I'm sorry. That was just what I don't know the answer to that bothered me, that I don't know the answer to. So I'll rely on both of you to give us an answer.
I will agree. I didn't anticipate that one either. I appreciate the history of the podium. I learned last week I was in Judge McBride's courtroom, and in the back of his courtroom, each side of the door, two murals, and learned that those were there created during the Depression era, and they're only one of the two courtrooms in the country that still has them.
Wow. I didn't know that.
I didn't know it either till last week. Mr. Worley told me. We will admit that Mr. Sartain was beaten severely. I don't think there's any doubt of that. The problem in this case is the insufficient evidence to prove that he was actually murdered. There's just no proof that he is deceased. There's no DNA, there's no blood, there's no DNA. If he was held in the bathtub, there would have been DNA in the drain. Claim they found where the car was taken. They found where the car was taken and allege or tried to prove that the body was in the car when it was there. There's no DNA from there. There's just nothing whatsoever except for one statement by Mr. Johns that says he saw Mr. Sartain's head held up by the ear to show that he is deceased. And that's just not enough corpus delicti to find that Mr. Arona is guilty of the offense of murder.
Does the record reflect whether the photograph that was shown to convince people to pay up was of a live person or a dead person?
The photograph, I don't think the photograph was produced and when it was shown as alleged to be him alive.
It was him alive?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And based upon the record, we submit there's just not enough evidence to find that Mr. Sartain is deceased. It's a big leap of faith to jump from the fact he was beaten up to we can't find him, so he must be dead. And we also submit that the judge erred in submitting criminally negligent homicide, and if it would have been submitted, the jury very well could have found that Mr. Arona was criminally negligent if Mr. Sartain is deceased. And I will promise I will go back to office and try to find. This is a very interesting point you brought up. And I will go back and submit something on that.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anybody have any questions? All right. We do appreciate your argument in your briefs and your cases submitted. Has some really interesting issues, and y'all handled them very well, and we do appreciate your assistance to the court. We're going to recess now briefly so that we can reform our new panel, and then we'll be back. And y'all are excused.
All rise.